What is it about dark matter? And what is it, actually? Lisa Randall will explain, here to talk about her new book, Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs.
Why it's called dark matter rather than ordinary matter is that it doesn't interact with light. That is to say, light goes right through it.
How do you escape North Korea and what's it like afterward on the outside? Louisa Lim will be here to talk about five new memoirs by people who have fled North Korea's communist dictatorship.
The other things that we learn about North Korea that are really alarming is the precariousness of life and really the weakness of family ties. How easy it seems to be for people to be so desperate there that they will sacrifice, you know, family members for their own survival. They'll sell children, parents, whoever.
Alexander Alter will give us an update from the literary world. And John Williams has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This is John Williams, an editor at The Times. I'm joined by Lisa Randall, who is a theoretical particle physicist, a professor at Harvard, and a best-selling author. Her new book is Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs, The Astounding Interconnectedness of the Universe, which is reviewed in this week's issue, and Lisa is here to talk about it. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Let's start with the basics, which I'm sure listeners will need here. What exactly is dark matter, and when did we discover it?
So dark matter is matter, and by that I mean it interacts with gravity-like matter. So, for example, it clumps together, like you see in galaxies. It's stuff that clumps together. Whereas something called dark energy is spread uniformly throughout the universe, dark matter is the stuff that clumps. Now, why it's called dark matter rather than ordinary matter is that it doesn't interact with light. That is to say, light goes right through it. It would be better called transparent matter because there's no interaction that we know of with light. So it interacts with gravity, but it's not made up of atoms. It's not made up of charged particles. So it's matter, but it's not the matter we're familiar with.
And how did we come across it?
The way we first found out about it was that dark matter through its gravitational influence, and I emphasize that, you know, an individual dark matter particle has very little influence. Billions of dark matter particles go through every second, and you don't know about it. But when you have a lot of dark matter, and it turns out that the energy carried by dark matter is five times the energy of normal matter, when you have a lot of dark matter, then it does have an enormous gravitational effect. And in particular, it was first noticed actually in the 1930s, looking at the Coma Cluster, a cluster of galaxies as a bunch of galaxies bound together by gravity. It was noticed that the galaxies move faster than they should, according to the amount of ordinary matter. That is to say, any matter is exerting a gravitational potential, which is holding stuff together. Mm-hmm. And it determines how fast things are moving. And stuff was moving too quickly to be accounted for by the matter that you could actually see that emitted visible light. But the way it was really pinned down a little bit better was in the 1970s when Vera Rubin and Ken Ford noticed that in our own Milky Way galaxy, stars are moving faster than you would expect based on the amount of visible matter. They thereby realized there had to be some matter that we just were not observing, and that is indeed the dark matter. But we now know about dark matter for other reasons, too. It also bends light. There's something called things like the Bullitt cluster, where galaxy clusters merge together, and you see the gas get stuck in the middle, but the dark matter, which is interacting so little, just goes right through.
Let's talk a bit about its role in the title of your book, and then we'll move on to some of the broader themes that you discuss. Tell us about your theory of how dark matter helped to kill off the dinosaurs.
So first of all, the dinosaurs were indeed killed off by an impact. And it's not just the dinosaurs. It was one of the five major mass extinctions that have occurred in the Phanerozoic Eon, that is to say, since the Cambrian era, in the last 500 million years. And it was a massive extinction. Probably three-quarters of the species on the planet disappeared.
Wow.
And it was caused by a big impact, something 10 to 15 kilometers big, hitting the Earth at, you know, probably at least 30 kilometers per second. It was a massive invasion of this big rock. But then the question that we asked was, what triggered that? Why did this big object come to Earth? Now, that's not necessarily a question that needs an answer. Stuff hits the Earth all the time. But big stuff hits much more rarely.
How often have big things hit us?
It looks like there's some evidence that stuff, say, bigger than a kilometer, is hitting, you know, every 30 million years or so. And so that's big stuff. You know, smaller stuff, again, is hitting much more often. But the big stuff hits more rarely, which is a very fortunate thing for life on the planet.
Yes.
It is actually not incidental. I mean, it is one of the things that's important for life on Earth, that stuff isn't hitting it all the time, that it's protected in some sense by the outer planets. It's It's really great the way it all hangs together. But in any case, this big thing hit. Then the question is, did something trigger this big hit? We weren't actually originally setting out to explain this. We were originally trying to, and that's to say my collaborators and I, were originally trying to explain some data where it looked like there was an excess signal that maybe existed and maybe originated from dark matter. But to explain that signal, it required dark matter to be denser than what we've observed so far. So we had the idea of, why can't there be a dark matter disk like the Milky Way disk, where the matter is much denser than it would otherwise be? I've told you that dark matter, there's 5 times the energy in dark matter than ordinary matter. Mm-hmm. Yet if you look around you, it's mostly matter. I mean, there is dark matter here too, but it's mostly matter, and that's because ordinary matter collapses into a disk. It radiates and thereby collapses into a disk. What happens is it loses energy, and that allows it to collapse.
This is in our everyday world when we look around.
Yeah, that's right. We're part of the Milky Way. In New York, you don't see it so clearly, but if you get outside the city, you see this brilliant band of the Milky Way. And that's a disk in the center of this approximately spherical halo of dark matter, which surrounds it. And ordinary matter collapsed into the disk. We suggested maybe, you know, not all the dark matter. We know there's this approximate spherical halo, but maybe a fraction of the dark matter collapsed into a disk. And if so, and here's the one other ingredient, the solar system actually orbits around the galaxy every 240 million years. And as it does so, it bobs slightly up and down through the plane of the galaxy. So what we suggested is that every time it goes through the plane of the galaxy, it goes through this dark matter disk, which exerts an excess gravitational force, an excess tidal force, that can actually dislodge objects out of what's called the Oort cloud. And the Oort cloud, which is really the final ingredient, is a bunch of icy bodies really at the edge of the solar system, thousands of times farther away from the sun than the Earth is. And those objects are weakly bound because they're so far away. So if you have any little kick on them, that can actually kick it out of its orbit. So we suggested, to summarize, that a dark matter disk kicks objects out of their orbit every approximately 30, 35 million years as the solar system goes through this dark matter disk.
And this is where, I guess, the paranoid people among us can sleep tight, because it seems like this would happen, as you said, maybe once every 30 or 32 million years.
Right. It's not happening for another 30 million years, at least this particular thing, even if our theory is right. That's not to say stuff doesn't hit, but it's usually small stuff that hit. And I actually had fun cataloging what is likely to hit how often. But I think we're okay as far as this particular problem goes.
A reviewer says that the book and your theory would force us to radically reappraise some of our most fundamental assumptions about the universe and our own existence. What is the nature of some of that reappraisal that's necessary if this theory is true?
I mean, one thing that I like to think about is the idea that, you know, a lot of people get disturbed by the idea of dark matter. They think of it as extremely foreign. And I actually make a lot of analogies to, you know, how we think about other cultures and things. You know, we just think of our own existence as more real. But, you know, from the dark matter point of view, it's very real. It's just matter. You know, the fact that we don't perceive it because we perceive it as light doesn't make it less real. One of the things we're saying is maybe dark matter, like ordinary matter, the matter we're familiar with, has some interesting structure. It consists of more than one type of particle. And so we're giving dark matter a little bit more richness that it doesn't have. So I guess part of the whole theme of the book is to say, all these other things that aren't as immediate to us that are essential to how we got here. Even aside from my particular extra ingredient here, and I should say that the dinosaur work is work I did with another professor, Matthew Rees, but even aside from that, dark matter was essential to the formation of structure in our universe. And, you know, the whole first section of my book really is about cosmology and how we got here. What are the kinds of questions we ask? And one of the interesting things is that because there is more matter, dark matter, again, has 5 times the energy of ordinary matter, structure could begin to form sooner. Structure could only form, and by structure I mean collapse into galaxies. The universe starts out uniform. That's the Big Bang Theory. You have a uniform, the radiation spread throughout the universe. But over time, the radiation dilutes, and it dilutes faster than matter. So eventually matter comes to dominate, and if you think about it, you could only really form structure when matter dominates. I mean, radiation doesn't clump together. So for us to get here, matter had to come to dominate, and it happened sooner, giving enough time for structure to form in the lifetime of our universe. Hmm. And furthermore, dark matter doesn't interact with light, so the light can't smooth out all the structure the way it would for ordinary matter. So I like to think of sort of ordinary matter as sort of hitchhiking along with dark matter. And dark matter is just plays an essential role. You know, it's like kind of like the underrepresented sections of society. You know, they're more numerous, but we forget about them in the headlines in our paper. But they're essential to building the things that are essential, foundational to our existence. And I kind of think of dark matter that way, by thinking of these other sections of the universe as so fundamental. And, of course, another way it's different is if it is indeed right, it is saying the galaxy is structured differently than we had thought, which is a pretty profound statement.
You talked about how you start the book with cosmology, and I wanted to ask you about that because you make mention in the book that, you know, you're dealing with some areas of science that have not been your specialty in the past, and I'm curious about the ways you find them interconnected and what drew you to this subject in particular.
I'll answer the last question first. I think two things sort of drew me to the subject in the sense that one thing was the opportunity to connect the fundamental, somewhat abstract stuff, the stuff that's really difficult to write about and explain, to stuff that's just much more immediate to our daily lives, to life itself even, but also to the shape of the planet and what's happening on the planet. And the other thing, of course, is that, you know, there's a lot of talk about what's happening to the planet today and the speed with which we're changing things on the planet, and not just inanimate objects, I mean, what we're doing to life itself. And I thought it was very important and also useful and interesting and kind of enriches the discussion to think about all the things that it took to get us here, all the interconnections that matter.
What were some of those?
Here's one. We've all heard about the carbon cycle, and of course we know the carbon cycle is essential to life. So first of all, I mean, you might have heard that carbon is produced, and it requires supernova to have this heavy elements produced, requires explosion of stars to make them in the first place. But on top of that, our planet relies on a carbon cycle, which has to do with plate tectonics, the fact that carbon can be released into the atmosphere and be absorbed. And it relies on this plate tectonics, which, you know, we really only found out about fairly recently, maybe the 70s. But plate tectonics, the fact that these plates are moving, relies in turn on the fact that the mantle is heating it. And the mantle heating it relies on nuclear decay, so nuclear decay processes. And it's not the way you usually think of it, the carbon, but all of these things are essential to the way it all works. And I like the fact that it goes through each, you know, many different layers of science to get to the point where we're talking about the carbon cycle, which is something, of course, we're very concerned about today.
And in terms of the future or what this, the book is not prescriptive, but what do you think that this theory in this book tells us about possible future consequences of our relationship to science and the Earth?
You know, I talk about sort of four, in the introduction, I talk about four general lessons that I had in this book. You know, one of them is just awe at how things fit together. You know, I do science, and I'm really happy just to do it. I really enjoy just the process and putting together connections, you know, figuring out how puzzles fit together. But it really is nice to take a step back and think about what it is that you're really thinking about and all the stuff that does fit together. And also really awe and wonder at the fact that we can figure it out. Mm-hmm. But another lesson is how recent a lot of the things we discovered are. Yet another lesson has to do with the rate of change, just how quickly things happen. And that's been a big debate in science, in sort of almost every kind of science you can think about. One question that comes up is how quickly do things change? So, for example, with evolution, Darwin had a picture that things change very slowly. Cuvier had a picture that things changed catastrophically. So he was the first person to realize extinctions can happen, mm-hmm. that things can really disappear forever. And, of course, we now know that it's a combination of the two. I mean, even in the evolution of the universe, there was the Big Bang theory where things were evolving relatively slowly, but we also now know about cosmological inflation, where things evolve very quickly in the early stages. So we have these two things that are, these two competing points of view. And I think right now we have a situation where things are changing very rapidly. Before the Industrial Revolution, life was contingent on the rate at which energy was hitting the Earth. And there was a fairly constant number of sort of megafauna, big animals. But with the Industrial Revolution, it changed and went down for a while, but then came back up. And now has escalated enormously as we go into the energy reserves. I mean, it's not called fossil fuel by accident. Fossil fuels really are from fossils.
Right.
And stuff that's been in the Earth and buried in the Earth, and it's taken a long time to get there. Yet by digging it up really quickly, we're changing things really quickly. And we're changing the surface of the planet very quickly. We're changing our way of life very quickly. We're changing the life that exists on the planet very quickly. I do think that when we consider what future changes and what we're doing today, it's important to think about how quickly this is happening and what we can recover and what we will lose irretrievably. What are the connections that really are required? And one of the big lessons is that it's not so simple. We can attack problems one at a time, and technology will solve some problems. But it's important to think about all the connections we might not even be aware of that are really essential to the ecosystems we have. Life as we know it could change radically. And it's important to think about which elements of those things we'd like to preserve.
Absolutely. Well, Lisa, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about it. The book, again, is Dark Matter and the Dinosaurs. It is reviewed in this week's issue of The Book Review. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with notes from the literary world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Next week, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux is publishing this strange little book. It is little. It's actually just 17 pages, which is already weird for them. But
is it a book or a booklet?
You could call it a booklet, but it's got a full story in it. And it's this mysterious production that kind of caught Silicon Valley by fire over the summer. The author is anonymous. The title is Iterating Grace, and it's kind of the satire of Silicon Valley culture. But the thing that was mysterious about it was that suddenly in June, a bunch of the top tech journalists in the country all got copies of this book delivered to them. And often in the address, it said that another journalist had sent it to them. So immediately accusations were flying around among these journalists saying, why did you send me this book? What does it mean? People tried to figure out who the author was. There were only 140 copies sent out of this self-published work.
It sounds like a prank.
It sounds exactly like a prank. So people kept waiting for the viral marketing scheme to unroll. One journalist I talked to still thinks, and this is Casey Newton, who's at The Verge, still thinks that it's either Mountain Dew or Taco Bell. But as weeks and months went on, these authors never came forward despite being prodded. They didn't want to take credit. And finally, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux acquired publication rights. They're going to be publishing it next week as a paperback, and only one person in the whole company in the contracts department knows the actual identity of the authors. So they truly want to remain anonymous.
It's the tech Elena Ferrante.
Exactly. It's the tech Elena Ferrante. And the funny thing about the book, it's sort of a subtly satirical story about a refugee from the first dot-com bubble who flees the country, goes to Bolivia, and starts to study tweets from venture capitalists with like spiritual intensity, trying to live his life according to these maxims. And the book reproduces the actual tweets from the venture capitalists, people like Chris Sacca and Mark Andreessen, who are big deals in this world, reproduces them in this sort of beautiful calligraphy. So FSG had to actually go to the venture capitalists and get permission to reproduce the tweets. But they're almost too good to be a parody. So that's why, in fact, they're real.
Gosh, it's just as a little cultural side note. This is the third time that Bolivia is appearing in a cultural phenomenon this fall. There was, of course, its role in Purity, Jonathan Franzen.
Right.
And then there was that Sandra Bullock movie, which alas flopped. And now this.
And
so
now
what
this.
Does it all mean for that little landlocked nation?
Exactly. And of course, as you can imagine, you know, when you enlist a bunch of journalists in your prank, there was plenty of coverage online when the book first circulated and a lot of finger pointing. Some of the people who were accused of being behind it were Joshua Cohen, who had his own big novel out about the internet over the summer. People thought this was sort of like a way to drum up publicity for that, but it wasn't him. Susan Orlean was actually accused of being behind it because someone did some kind of stylistic analysis of the writing and the prose style. It's not quite as good as Susan Orlean, but she did not write it. And Dave Eggers was also a culprit. Robin Sloan. None of those people actually wrote it. So.
My theory is it's you, Alexandra.
Well, I'm not going to say anything.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Louisa Lim joins me now. She writes in this week's issue, The Shortlist Review, which covers 5 memoirs about fleeing North Korea. They are 1,000 Miles to Freedom by Yoon-sun Kim, In Order to Live by Yeonmi Park, The Girl with 7 Names by Hyun-seo Lee, Stars Between the Sun and Moon by Lucia Jang, and Under the Same Sky by Joseph Kim. Louisa Lim is a professor of journalism at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and the author of The People's Republic of Amnesia, Tiananmen Revisited. Hi, Louisa.
Hi.
So let's start, I guess, by taking these books quickly one by one. Let's start with Yoon Sun Kim's book, A Thousand Miles to Freedom. What was her background and how did she get out of North Korea?
So her background is that she is living with her mother and her younger sister in order that they're basically starving. And her mother becomes so desperate to feed the family that she commits this crime, which is punishable by death. She's already sold everything that is in the house, and they take down the portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, the Korean leaders, that hang in every house in North Korea and are worshipped like sacred objects. She takes them down, and she dismantles the frames to sell them. And then this plunges the family into poverty, and they, for a while they're living rough. And then they flee to China by wading through a river, and they have this extraordinary journey, 9 years in China, during which they are sold as a family to this abusive farmer who beats the mother. And eventually they escape through the Gobi Desert to Mongolia. So it's this extraordinary story of survival, as are every single one of these five books.
Yes, and Yoon Sun was a child during this?
Yes, she was. I think she was 11 years old at the start of this. So it's very much told through a child's eyes.
And then In Order to Live, A North Korean Girl's Journey to Freedom by Yeonmi Park. Park was a relatively privileged person in North Korea. In fact, you say in the review that she was nicknamed the Paris Hilton of North Korea, which at first made me think she would have a much different experience. But of course, once these lives start to fray and people leave the country, it's just equally hard for everyone, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. And actually, her life had begun to fray even before she left North Korea. Her father had actually been involved in illegal market activity. He'd been smuggling metal on the black market, and he was caught and sent to prison. And so she ended up fleeing to China with her mother. She's become quite well known in South Korea because she was on this reality TV show which stars North Korean refugees. The way that she fled wasn't really, all of the details weren't known until she wrote this tell-all book, and she has this extraordinary story how she fled age 13 and she became the mistress of this violent human trafficker, this Chinese human trafficker. And she ended up effectively buying her mother's freedom and her father's exit from North Korea. But she also ended up working for the trafficker and selling other North Korean women. And eventually she buys back her own freedom with gold jewelry that she's hidden. And she makes it to South Korea. But one of the interesting things about her is that she is still seen by the North Koreans as a threat, and the North Korean propaganda apparatus actually issued this long 18-minute video which was aimed at discrediting her and at discrediting this book. So I think it shows that they are worried about these stories that are being told.
Are they concerned especially with her because of her fame?
I think so. I mean, I think that she, actually many of these books are written by people who have some level of profile overseas. You know, a lot of them have given TED Talks that went viral, and the same goes for Hyunseo Lee, who wrote The Girl with Seven Names. Especially her and Yeonmi Park, they're very articulate, and the stories that they tell are just so shocking. In Yeonmi Park's case, when she went on a stage and told the story, the entire audience was weeping. And I think North Korea is the master of propaganda, sees what these stories do when they're told overseas, the kind of pictures they paint.
And Hyunseo Lee's book, The Girl with Seven Names, what does that title refer to?
So this title refers to what she went through in order to escape. Every time she went to a new place, she took on a new identity. So it really is a story about how many different changes and different identities, different people you have to become to escape North Korea, and she spent time in China, a long time in China, actually, during which she lied to everyone, including even her own boyfriend, did not know that she was North Korean.
Did you get the sense reading the book that all of this switching of identities and having to live under different guises has left her sort of fundamentally untrustworthy or fundamentally not knowing who she is?
She herself admits that. She said that the tragedy of North Korea is that everyone wears a mask. And I think that this is really a problem for, she admits it's a problem for her, that she never really peels those masks away. You know, deep down, it's difficult for her to even know who she really is. So I think there is an emptiness at many, at the heart of her book and of many of these. And it's a really interesting point that several of them talk about growing up in North Korea. Some of the key vocabulary that we use, they did not use. You know, the word for love, you could only love the leader, Kim Il-sung, and Kim Jong-il, you couldn't love anybody else. So Yeonmi Park talks about how she didn't even have this vocabulary of emotion when she went to South Korea, that she had to learn how to feel again.
You make that point also with Yunsin Kim's book, A Thousand Miles to Freedom, which is the first one we started discussing. She escaped with her mother and obviously went through, you know, many harrowing situations. And you said that it sort of, you know, left her blunted in a way. You described the prose as blunted, and it kind of mirrors maybe how she's become herself.
Yes. I mean, it was something that I really noticed reading one after another of these books, that the language itself, there was very little space for imagination in the language used in these books. And a lot of that was due to the kind of education that North Koreans get. Most of these books were written by young people in their 20s and 30s. You know, the education, even for these young people, a lot of it is basically propaganda or these self-criticism sessions where you stand up and you criticize other people, or time basically working as unpaid farm labor in the fields. And it's astonishing the dearth of imagination, how that plays out in a country that doesn't allow imagination to flourish. You know, when you read these books, some of them, the language was so sparse. There were no adjectives. There were no metaphors. And I really began to notice this in book after book. It was really quite chilling in a way.
Yeah, that the country had sort of done its terrible job so well. Moving left to right, the fourth of these five books, Stars Between the Sun and Moon, which is by a woman named Lucia Jang. You say, and reading all five of these reviews in this week's issue, it's striking just how brutal all of these stories are. And yet you start your review of her book by saying, on the misery index, this book receives a solid 10 out of 10. Was this the most jarring and dispiriting of the five?
So many terrible things happened to all of these authors that I ended up with a spreadsheet because I couldn't remember what had happened to whom. Several of them went to various prisons. You know, several of them had dealings with human traffickers. There were tales of kidnapping, tales of trading sex. Dreadful, dreadful stories.
People are selling their own family members.
There was one, the fifth book, Joseph Kim, where he writes about how he possibly might have eaten human flesh without realizing it.
Wow.
So the stories are really shocking, but Lucia Jang's, I think, was the most shocking. She married a man who was abusive and unfaithful, who was alcoholic. He had accumulated all these debts, and he secretly sold their baby for 300 won and 2 bars of soap. And her mother even colluded with this.
Wow.
After Lucia Jang fled to China, she was sold to a man who she described as a village idiot. She escaped from him. She was caught. She was sent back twice to North Korean prisons. And her descriptions of life inside the prisons are just astonishingly grim. And she eventually ends up living as a kind of common-in-law wife to a Chinese farmer. But she's repatriated again whilst pregnant. And she finally escapes North Korea with this baby and smuggles her son to Mongolia and subsequently to freedom. So her book is the darkest, it's the grimmest, it's truly depressing. But I think it's saved by her own personality. She is slightly older than the other authors, and she writes about, you know, how she shared food in prison to the extent that she herself put her own health in danger by sharing food with other people, and the kind of pacts that she made with other other people in prison in order to give them something to live for. She managed to be so compassionate in such circumstances. And other people wrote about this as well. I mean, Joseph Kim said that the one thing that they learned in North Korea was that you have to be selfish, otherwise you will die. If you don't constantly put yourself first, you will die. And she was the one person who did not do that and still survived.
Yeah, it's amazing. You were talking about how when she fled to China, she was sold to someone. And obviously, a lot of these people sort of escaped a terrible situation only to find another terrible situation. Joseph Kim's book, which is called Under the Same Sky, is subtitled From Starvation in North Korea to Salvation in America. How did Kim get out and where is he now?
He's still very young. And his family background was that his mother ended up selling his beloved sister in China and abandoning him in a market. So he became what is known as a kochebi, a wandering sparrow, basically a beggar. This also happened to Yoon-sun Kim's family. They were also kochebi for a while, but his experience is particularly interesting because he was basically living alone on his wits at the age of 13. His descriptions of that, of how he became a pickpocket and then a burglar, and how then he was sent to a detention center, and how he basically escaped, did various jobs, and ended up just walking to China. They're really very interesting. He's quite a perceptive person. He has ended up in the U.S. He is living in New Jersey, I think.
How did he get to America?
When in China, he managed to find a Christian group that arranged his passage to America.
Let's zoom out for a minute, and because obviously reading these five books in quick succession must have been, I would think, almost traumatic. But what did they tell you as a group about life inside of North Korea? And are they focused more on life inside the country or more on the experience of leaving it and what happened after?
There's really a double focus. And I mean, one of the shocking things is that no matter how bad life is in North Korea, at least they knew the system, they knew the game. Once they leave in China, and China doesn't recognize North Korean refugees, it will repatriate them if it catches them, then the situation becomes even worse. I think what it tells us about life in North Korea is particularly fascinating. I mean, we learn a lot about the gradations, the political gradations in North Korea, how there's this system called Songbun. So there's 51 different classes of people, but you're basically divided into different categories that come under three main headings, either loyal, wavering, or hostile politically. And your entire life depends on that gradation. And what's interesting is the extent to which the elite within the system, the loyal people, manage to break the rules all the time. The case of Yomi Park, whose father smuggled metal on the special presidential train, or also Hyun-soo Lee, whose mother was very elite and used that status to conduct all kinds of illegal smuggling. So that was particularly interesting. And also, because a lot of the authors of these books are very young, they write about being part of the market generation, the Jangmadang generation, and how that has changed life in North Korea. That is very telling. But I think the other things that we learn about North Korea that are really alarming is the precariousness of life and really the weakness of family ties, how easy it seems to be for people to be so desperate there that they will sacrifice, you know, family members for their own survival. They'll sell children, parents, whoever.
Why does that normally happen?
And normally it's simply they cannot survive. There's that the families, in most of these cases, there are family members who starve to death. There was a famine in 1994, but actually the food shortages have been chronic. And often the families just simply cannot survive. And there are these just terrible scenes in several of the books where they go from relation to relation trying to get food and are turned away at door after door.
You mentioned the fact that the elite families get to break the rules, and I'm wondering about, in particular, Yeonmi Park, who wrote In Order to Live, and Hyun-Seo Lee, who wrote The Girl with Seven Names. Is it just a matter of that even the elite eventually just cross the wrong person and have to flee, or did the scales drop from their eyes about the larger society, so they decide to leave?
In those cases, I think that they did end up, family members ended up crossing the wrong person and having to flee. That was certainly the case in Yeonmi Park. For Hyun-Seo Lee, it was a little different. She had really grown up with this life of privilege. She didn't even realize that other people were going hungry until she was a teenager. And she simply decided that it would be thrilling to have a holiday with relatives in China. So she decided, because she'd always lived near the border area, and that's a common feature of the authors of these books, many of them lived near China. So she decided to make a go for it by herself. And it's also a common feature of all five authors. There's this kind of astonishing level of naivete. And I think Yeonmi Park really puts her finger on it. She says, we weren't capable of critical thinking because we had been trained not to ask questions. Often they make terrifically bad decisions, and they keep making terrifically bad decisions. You wonder where the capacity for critical thinking is. In the case of Yoon-Soon Kim, they fled this farmer who had beaten them, but they kept going back and back to him. In another case, they were also going back, returning to people who trafficked them simply because they didn't know anyone else. And they were desperate and they were gullible and they'd never really been taught to think.
Well, and they'd also, I guess, sadly been taught to sort of expect the worst from people in many ways. Of the five books, is there one that stands out for you if people wanted to read one or two of them to get a sense of life inside the country and an author's voice?
I was particularly moved by Lucia Zhang's book just because of her ability to withstand things that you imagine human beings couldn't possibly survive and still be compassionate. I like Joseph Kim's book as well, just because he was giving such a street-level view that I had never really heard before, the view from the petty thief. And I thought that he was very perceptive.
Well, all five of these books, it sounds like, shed light on a country that is very dark and secretive to all of us. Louisa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about them.
Oh, thank you.
That was Louisa Lim, who reviews five memoirs about fleeing North Korea in the shortlist in this week's book review.
John Williams, standing in for Greg Coles, has bestseller news this week. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
What's new on the list this week is all over on the fiction side. There's nothing new on the nonfiction list. But at fiction, we'll start at number 16 with Warheart by Terry Goodkin. That's the conclusion of a series. At number 12, there's Rules for a Night, which is a book by the actor Ethan Hawke, and it's kind of an odd project. It's letters that he wrote from the perspective of an imagined medieval ancestor of his, and it's about instructions for children and ethical behavior.
Not his first book.
No, he wrote a couple of novels back when, but I don't think he's written a book in a while, and he returns with sort of an odd but obviously popular project. Up at number 9, Richard Paul Evans, who has a Christmas-themed book every year around this time, has The Mistletoe Inn, his latest. At number 8, The Pharaoh's Secret by Clive Cussler and Graham Brown. And at number 7, Mary Higgins Clark, who's had a long career as a bestseller writing books by herself, has teamed up with the writer Alifair Burke to write a book called All Dressed in White. This is Clark's third bestseller of this year. Up at number 2 is David Baldacci, whose new novel is called The Guilty, and he is no stranger to the top of the list. But he's beat out at the very top this week by Janet Ivanovich's new book, Tricky 22.
All right. What's been on the list for the longest on the fiction side?
On the fiction side, it is Anthony Doerr's Unstoppable, All the Light We Cannot See, which still hangs in there at number 11 after 81 weeks on the list. And that's obviously a pretty literary book, won the Pulitzer Prize, and it is hanging in there. I guess people are buying it for the holidays now in addition to its previous sales.
All right. Let's give nonfiction its moment. There's nothing new, but what's up there at top?
Up there at the top is Bill O'Reilly and his co-writer Martin Duggard and their book Killing Reagan, another in their series of hugely selling bestsellers about historical figures and their deaths. At number two, Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates. And at number three, which was last week's top seller, is John Meacham's Destiny and Power, his big new biography of former President George H.W. Bush.
All presidents at the top. Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.